Welcome to the Fuller Tracy Money Audio Commentary. This is Owen Tracy recording at 12:59 p.m. That is Pacific Summer Time. Today is June 15th, and today being Friday, it's the big picture long-term audio and video for the various different asset classes. Well, today was a news-laden week, and a lot of the news was, heavily anticipated, but what set the markets alight and the news reels spinning quickly was the fact that the Trump administration has instituted $50 billion worth of tariffs on China. Well, since the beginning of the year, the Chinese stock market has failed to sustain an upward break and then has held a progression of lower rally highs and moved to a new reaction low this week. And this has broken the uptrend since the beginning of 2016. So what I had been regarding as a largely manufactured uptrend from a government perspective since the beginning of 2016 is now over, and they are leaning heavily on the shadow banking sector. Now, there is an additional point, and it is that they are also now allowing defaults. And defaults are a new concept for the Chinese financial markets, because until quite recently, there weren't any. And in 2016, which is the number, which is the year where we have from going back with whatever records we have, it was the highest number of defaults. There was 21 defaults in that year. Well, we're almost up to that for 2018 already, and we're not even halfway through the year yet. Perhaps even more important than that, considering a country the size of China, that it only had 21 defaults in the entire year of 2016, is still an extraordinarily low number. Now, one of the things that we have in developed markets is a well-developed corporate bond market. So we have some form of idea about what is a normal run rate in terms of the default rate, and that it goes down in good times and it generally goes up a bit in bad times, and it's something that people can monitor. But when you have an immature corporate bond market, such as you have in China, we just do not know what that answer is. We don't know what a normal default rate is, and we don't know what it could likely go to in extremis. And not least because the Chinese market has been ticking along at an incredible growth rate for decades. And it has not had a recession. So we just don't know where the default rate is. And of course, because of the buildup of debt and because of the buildup of leverage and the way that the financial system is integrated with the government, well, then it's a very opaque system to begin with. So it's even harder to come up with a clear vision for what that number could potentially be. Then on top of all of that, you have the fact that despite the fact that China has been investing and making a priority of developing a domestic consumer economy, it is still a very large export-oriented economy. And the prospect of trade sanctions, or what are most colloquially called tariffs, that is a headwind. But it's most particularly a headwind for China versus the USA. The USA is certainly a big exporter, but it is not as dependent on its export sector as China is, and therefore that is likely that is one of the reasons that the US probably has concluded that it can afford to engage in a trade war. Well, a lot of commentators have been of the opinion that it's too early to say that it's a trade war. They've been saying it's a spat. They've been saying it's a disagreement. But one thing that I think is really very relevant is that on the one hand, there is an identity crisis in the West, and we've had the rise of populism, which I have described as a revolution against the status quo, but is more regularly described as a rise of populism or a rise of anti-immigration sentiment. It's a rise of isolationism or xenophobia. And in some sections, it's even taken the guise of anti-Semitism. And none of these are particularly attractive qualities. But what we also know is that, and it is something that we know from crowd psychology, simple enough that when you have a crowd, that the emotional quotient goes down, that crowds are incapable of higher order thinking. Crowds only appeal to the most base of emotions, and therefore, if you want the crowd to listen to you, you have to paint in the most strident colors. That's almost a direct quote from Freud. And that is why these very guttural, very base emotions tend to play well with the crowd. And what it also tells us is that the trend towards centerism, which over the course of the last 40 years has resulted in the range of choices available to the electorate have decreased, that there has been a certain way of governing which has been reliant on basically taking surveys, and this is not the particular way to govern when you have problems that have been papered over. The fact, for example, that you had the first past the post system in the UK means that all you had to do was appeal to 51% of the population and you were elected. And that is one of the faults of the democratic system in some respects, because it doesn't make a great deal of difference when there's not that much difference between the haves and the have-nots, the winners and the losers. But when you have a lot of people that have become disaffected, then it creates a very wide band between the winners and the losers, and you have a lot of disaffected people. Well, one of the questions I've been asked, I think more than anything, any other in the last few years, has been what's going to happen when robots take my jobs? And the pace of technological innovation is certainly rallying. What I find particularly interesting today is that when we look at the Nasdaq 100, that it paired almost it well in one point it did not pull back by very much at all, and then it rallied well off its lows. But perhaps more important than that is that it is trading at new highs. Well, if we simply look at the difference in the trends between what's happening on the Nasdaq and what's happening in China, well, I think we can see clearly in which direction the global investor the community is voting. Technological innovation is a very real phenomenon, and it is inherently deflationary. The very reason that technology tends to trend higher is because it allows us to do more with less. And when we think about doing more with less, then workers tend to take some of the brunt of that. Well, that has, I think, raised fears, most particularly in places like the US and the UK, because their manufacturing sectors have been decimated over the course of the last few decades. It's certainly a considerably more well-developed trend in the UK than it is in the USA, but certainly in the USA, there has been a clear shift since 2000. And the other big thing that happened in the early 2000s was that China entered the WTO. And that is when it started to become the real workshop of the world. And it wasn't simply that you had technological innovation, but rather you had competition from globalization. And that has resulted in whole industries being lifted lock, stock, and barrel out of the industrial heartlands of Europe and North America and into the emerging markets. And therefore, it isn't so much. And then, if we also look at who have been the beneficiaries from globalization, well, it's countries like Japan and South Korea, Germany, and China. Well, South Korea has got more robots per head of capita than any other country. Singapore is next on that list, but it isn't a particularly large manufacturing sector. Let's leave that out for a moment. Next is Germany and then Japan. Well, the USA is way down the list, and the UK is even further down the list. Therefore, when we look at the beneficiaries, it is those that have embraced automation have been the ones that have held on to their manufacturing sectors, and that is despite the onslaught from the admission of China to the World Trade Organization. So therefore, when we think about what is the real question we should be asking, rather than when is a robot going to take my job, perhaps a better question is, when am I going to get a robot to help me keep my job? For example, we've already seen that with Tesla, that they went for or they tried to have an almost completely automated manufacturing process, and have more recently discovered that that's not something that they can achieve, and that they have had to create some nuance in their manufacturing process so that there are definitely jobs that people are simply better at. And that's where technology is at the present moment. We're still at a point where there are definitely jobs that people are better at. Well, if it isn't then technological innovation that is the primary driver in terms of this disaffection that we're seeing in a substantial number of people that have lost their jobs, then it has to be because of globalization. Therefore, when we think about what is it that is going to animate people, it's this fervor for anti-globalization. That is, I think, what is driving these tariffs that the USA is instituting. It isn't simply that, for example, Angela Merkel this week was arguing that the USA, in fact, runs a trade surplus with Germany because it exports so many services. But those services are provided from very low headcount labor-intensive industries like Google and Facebook. And that is just not at all what voters are interested in. So that is one of the problems that is going to arise from the imposition of trade tariffs, that on the one hand, they're going to be roundly cheered by people who have been who've seen their standard of living decline. One of the most important points about manufacturing jobs is that they tend to pay better than service-oriented jobs. Generally speaking, people who work in factories get paid better than people who work as hairdressers and wait staff. So there is a really quite a profound movement going on right now to raise the minimum wage for wait staff, and that is something that is gradually making its way around from state to state in the USA. But most particularly, it's gaining ground because there are just so many people in that particular state of affairs today. That simply was not the case 20 years ago. The real growth in employment has been within these service sectors, and those are generally low-paying jobs. So when we think about why is it that the pace of job growth has not been rallying more, well, we have to think that that has to be part of the reason, that earnings growth has been around the 2.5% level now for about 3 years, and it is firming within the range, but it's not rallying higher. And part of the reason for that is because, generally speaking, manufacturing jobs are generally pay more, but they are also something that is very, I think, cyclical in nature. So we can see, for example, that if you look at the number of people that are employed in manufacturing, it absolutely collapsed from the late 1990s until 2010. And we have had one of the most profound bouts of monetary accommodation since 2009. And in that time, it has resulted in manufacturing jobs increasing by approximately 1 million people. Now, it's been trending higher. There's no doubt about that. But if you go back and look at history, it tends to move up and down a lot more. And that's something that we get with the ebb and flow of the cycle in terms of the economy, that manufacturing generally tends to get hit hard in a recession and then tends to come back fast in a recovery. But that is just not happening any longer. What it also suggests is that without some profound change, the next time we have a recession, then manufacturing is really going to decline very abruptly in the USA and also within the UK. The UK's downtrend in manufacturing has been going on for much longer than in the USA. And there has been almost a singular bet on the fortunes of London. So that does raise rather important questions about the wisdom of Brexit and the need for some kind of transitionary agreement, not least because, yes, there are millions of people who have lost their jobs and have been unseated by the loss of manufacturing from just about every part of the UK, but nothing much has appeared to come back and pay the same amount of money. And those people are obviously disaffected, whereas London has been largely immune to that particular drive, which is why you have this big difference in the way that different parts of the country voted on the Brexit question. And then you also have exactly the same thing in the USA, where different parts of the country have been affected differently by the loss of manufacturing and of now more recently the coal mining industry, and they are voting differently. Well, we know which demographic President Trump represents, and that is having an impact. Well, then you have to also look at it from the perspective of the of those that have benefited most from globalization, which are, on the one hand, China. I think on a secondary is the rest of the emerging markets, and then Europe. Europe benefits enormously from exporting into China, exporting the kinds of machinery that it requires to become the and maintain its position as the workshop for the world. So when we think about where the risks are, then certainly China could potentially come under pressure. And that leaves, a risk for the kinds of companies that have been very successfully exporting into China, and that's most particularly in Germany and in the Netherlands, but also in Italy. Now, the DAX index is continuing to trade above 12,000, and the Europe stocks 600 has been ranging below the 400 point level for the last 18 years. So if it is going to break on the upside, it's probably going to require that the euro trend lower. And there is the realistic possibility of that. When we see this week that the euro encountered resistance in the region of the trend mean, and that the Europeans definitely do not want a stronger currency. That Mario Draghi yesterday basically said that they're definitely not raising interest rates until the summer of next year. So that is going to put additional downward pressure on the euro. And the Australian dollar also pulled back sharply from the region of its trend mean. It had held a progression of either equal or higher reaction lows from early 2016, and that is now over. It has now encountered resistance in the region of the trend mean rather than support, and it is coming back down to test its recent lows. Well, it has got work to do now to question the downward bias, and the Australian dollar has historically had a positive yield differential with just about all other major currencies, but that is no longer the case. Interest rates are still around 1.5%. They are higher in the USA, so you're not getting the yield pickup, and with the potential for China to have some trouble, then commodity demand growth may not be there either. So in much the same way that the European stock market tends to move in an inverse correlation relative to the currency, well, the ASX 200 was up in a dynamic manner in here today, from bouncing from the 6,000 area. It's been largely range-bound around 6,000 now for most of the year already. There has been an upward bias, but it has been a very choppy trend since the beginning of 2016, and there is the potential for it to do better from here as the currency comes under pressure. And I think it is going to be an inverse correlation, so then we have to think about the potential that it is going to be susceptible to exactly what happens with the currency. Well, you tend to get these inverse correlations with Australia and with Europe, and you also get it with Japan. The Japanese yen tends to rally in periods of market stress, but it was pretty much unchanged in here today. The more important point is that Japan is a long way from raising interest rates or even abandoning its quantitative easing program. And part of the quantitative easing program is in there buying ETFs. And that is helping the Nikkei to sustain the move above 20,000. But most particularly, the dollar is finding support now in the region of 110 and the region of the trend mean. So that is holding out the prospect that the dollar will start to rally once more against the yen. If that is indeed the case, then in nominal prices, the Nikkei should remain reasonably firm. And it has been consolidating above the trend mean now for the last few weeks. But the most important point is that it has held the move above 20,000. I'm posting a report today from Jefferies talking about increasing activism in the Japanese stock market, and that could be really beneficial for the shareholder base, not least because it would help to unlock some of the value. The topics is trading at a price to book of about 1.33, and the topics banks index is trading at a price to book of about 0.55, and it is trading at a substantial discount relative to the wider market, but it's also pretty close to approximating the levels that we saw back in 2003. And we know what happened after that. There was a spectacular rally in the Japanese banks. Well, if Japan can succeed in continuing to stimulate its stock market, then it would appear to be only a matter of time before the banks start to perform. At a price to book of about 0.55, it does appear to me at least that there is value to be unlocked, and it has been ranging mostly around 175 for more than a year already, and it really does need to hold that 175 area if potential for additional higher to lateral ranging is to be given the benefit of the doubt. Obviously, if Japan were ever to raise interest rates, that is what would prove to be a very important catalyst for the banking sector. But we're probably not there just yet. Then we have to think about what is it that China is going to do. Well, China has been in expansionary mood. And they have, on the one hand, they've been building a blue water navy. They've been investing in overseas military bases, and they have been buying their way into the political classes in a whole slew of emerging market countries, but most particularly those that are big commodity producers. They have been courting relations with countries like Sri Lanka and Pakistan in an effort to surround India. They have been courting a number of African regimes in an effort to establish a foothold on the continent. And what are they going to do in terms of their competition with the USA? Well, they are attempting at present to take the higher ground, and to the moral high ground, I think would probably be the better term. That may not last, but what we can definitely see today is that the talk of trade tensions is having an impact on commodities, and China is by far the largest consumer of commodities these days. Well, Brent crude has pulled back by $2.70 in here today, and that is extending this mean reversion pullback. So it is increasing now the potential that we are going to pull back towards the trend mean. There is, I think, an area of potential support around $70, and by the time it gets there, the trend mean may approximate it. Then the question would be whether we're going to find support. What is rather interesting is that West Texas Intermediate has been exhibiting relative weakness, not least because there is a supply glut in Texas because of a lack of pipeline infrastructure, and it was down by $2.25 in here today, so it is right back on its lows. It was a pretty meager advance over the course of the last 10 sessions, and now it is right on the low. So a clear upward dynamic would require to question that I think a further test of underlying trading in here. We also know that OPEC is going to be increasing its supply, and this graphic was on Twitter today, and it's Russia's. Well, it's from Wood Mackenzie, and it's Russia's plans to rapidly increase supply by at least a couple of 100,000 barrels a day. That's not a huge amount, but obviously Saudi Arabia and OPEC will also be kicking in. So there is the potential that we are moving back into a supply-dominated environment for oil prices. And my contention from really a couple of years ago was that $70 is about where new supply is likely to come back into the market. That it's the break-even for a substantial quantity of additional new supply in the oil markets. So when prices get above 70, that's when you start to see people starting to reinvest in drilling and new supply coming to the market. And that's in fact exactly what we've seen, that supply has been rapidly increasing in the USA as a result of prices coming back up to economic levels. And because the futures curve has been not quite as steep as one might have imagined, then it's been possible to hedge until quite recently at least about $60 all the way out to 2019, that you can still hedge out to 2025 at $52. And there's a good share of oil that is economic at $52. So I think that's an important point, that there is plenty of additional oil. And when we think about it in those terms, then I think we should also think about what it is that we can expect over the very long term. Because when you look at the historic oil price, it is prone to these very long ranges. And the likelihood is that the lower side of this range is somewhere below $40, and the upper side of the range in extremis is probably going to be somewhere around $100. And in between, we're going to have volatile ranging. And that is a range in the order of 300% from the trough to the peak. And what that's going to create is medium-term trends, but it's going to be a trader's environment. It is not going to be the kind of environment that I think prevailed for most of the decade from the late 1990s. And we could be waiting for a substantial period of time before we see that kind of sustained bull market in oil prices again. Then, of course, we have the evolution of technology on the energy front, where you have battery technology improving rather rapidly. I tend to think of Tesla as a canary in the coal mine. It is a, I think at this stage, I'm just going to check that, but I believe it's a CC rated bond. CC plus rated credit. So therefore, it is the junk of junk from the rating agency's perspective. And yet, the share has rallied very impressively over the last 2 weeks, and it has now broken the progression of lower rally highs. So this is rather a profound change of fate for the share, considering it was at 250 not so long ago. And that represents really a quite acute failed downside break, and it increases the potential that the next area of potential resistance is somewhere just below $400. Well, Tesla exists because of access to cheap credit. There is absolutely no way they could have spent the quantity of money that they have if they had not had access to very accommodative credit conditions. So that's a very big point, that when eventually credit conditions become tighter, then that is when the big questions are going to be asked of companies like Tesla and indeed of Netflix. Netflix is currently trading on an estimated PE of 136. That's substantially better than the historic PE of 248, but the price is now at $400. And that's another big psychological level. And you can see that it paused around 100, it paused around 200, it paused around 300. So I think there is a strong likelihood that Netflix is going to pause around 400. But it's unlikely to collapse until we get some of the credit starting to get pulled back in. When we think about what the likelihood of that is, well, then we kind of have to look at the bonds. Well, it's got a B plus rated credit, but there's a substantial amount of the debt that has got reasonably long maturities. So that's an important point in the company's favor, that the next time it has to mature a bond is going to be in 2021. So that's the deadline by which they need to be generating income by so that they can meet their obligations. And that's, I think, when you look at this trend, it has certainly accelerated, and most particularly since the beginning of this year, almost doubling so far this year. Then, if it is due some consolidation, we have evidence that people are willing to sit through approximately a $100 reaction. And what that suggests is that it could have some rather acute volatility, and as long as it's holding the progression of higher reaction lows, people are probably willing to give it the benefit of the doubt. But this also helps to just ram home the point that it is in the provision of services and the adoption of a subscription business model and the which has streamlined cash flows for what would have previously been considered highly cyclical business models. That has translated into these higher valuations being accepted. And I think there's the CEO of one of the new IPOs, Zura, has even written a book on the subscription model. So what that helps to, I think, ram home is that you have companies that are setting up with the express purpose of adopting the subscription business model. And the stock market is now absolutely in adoration of this new business model. It is the new business model for the new age. And this is the kind of activity that you get in a developing mania phase. Now, I think it is arguable to question whether we are in a new mania phase, but I think we are entering it. We are entering the third psychological perception stage of this bull market, where people start to think about subscriptions as being the crock of gold at the end of the rainbow, that people are willing to pay a little bit often rather than a lot in one go. That is certainly what is helping, well, it has helped drive the transformation in the trend for Microsoft. It has done exactly the same thing for Adobe. And it is what is helping to animate a lot of the computer games manufacturers. So when we think about these trends, they're all driven by the subscription business model. Well, there is the counter argument to the subscription business model, and it is that people can cancel your subscription. And that is something that does not appear to be, I think, inherent in the performance of any of these shares. But when do people cancel their subscriptions? It's usually during a recession. And then people start to really think about what is it that is most value to them, and everything else starts to get cut. And that is then when some of the business models behind the corporate balance sheet optimization of these companies is going to get questioned. In the meantime, this is certainly the business model that is most in fashion, and it is likely to be the sector that tends to lead us into this third psychological perception stage of this medium-term bull market. And I think that is one of the great examples of the endlessly fractal nature of bull markets, that you get cyclical bulls within secular bulls. You get cyclical bears within secular bulls. And then at the end of it all, you get a secular bear. Well, the secular bear ended in my opinion, in 2012. And we're now in a secular bull market for Wall Street. And now we're getting a new business model getting adopted. And that is representative of the kinds of financial innovations that you get in all bull markets. Every single bull market has a fresh financial innovation. And in this particular bull market, there is a massive competition for what that financial innovation is. On the one hand, it might be the introduction of ETFs and the fact that it is now possible to invest for anybody in just about anything, and that the cost of doing so is relatively small. And that is the clear benefit of the ETF market. For every benefit in a financial innovation, there is going to be a downside. And from the perspective of ETF investors, it is that the nature of most ETFs is that they're market cap weighted. And therefore, what you are in fact investing in is in a momentum strategy. Because if the bigger companies get bigger and drive the performance of the market, what you end up with is a concentrated portfolio dependent on momentum. But as long as the price is going up, nobody's really going to worry about that. Then you have Bitcoin and the cryptocurrencies, and that has been heralded as a wonderful financial innovation. And I think that perhaps the blockchain will eventually become something that companies will in fact use. But that does not mean that people will have to use cryptocurrencies for doing so. And we're already starting to see the migration from that. There is this, utopian ideal that people can mine cryptocurrency and be part of a community, and that everyone gets along in a kumbaya kind of way. But the reality is that it's just not how a capitalist economic system works. And eventually, I think it is going to get swept away by the commoditization of the technology. And Bitcoin this week pulled back rather sharply. And it was up in positive territory yesterday on the US decision that Ethereum is not in fact a security. So is therefore not susceptible to, onerous regulatory oversight. But I think it is important that the moving average for Bitcoin is now starting to look downwards, that it pulled back and made a new low, and that it now has got some significant work to do if the downtrend is going to be reversed. And that means it would have to sustain a move above the trend mean to question the downward bias. And I've been looking at the log scale chart for quite some time because most people involved in cryptocurrencies are unleveraged, and that means they are more interested in percentage moves than the movement in points. And what that suggests to me is that the progression of higher reaction lows was around the 7,000 level, and it is now in fact below the low that we saw in April. Well, we looked at, for example, the Australian dollar, which had that progression of higher reaction lows from the beginning of 2016, and then it broke it and then pulled back in a dynamic manner. Well, Bitcoin gapped lower earlier on this week. And there's nothing more dynamic than a gap lower. So I think that there is a realistic possibility that Bitcoin is going to break the 6,000 level. And then where is the next area of potential support? Well, the last major high was around 5,000, and the next major high below that is 3,000. And then, of course, the really big level that everyone got really interested in, Bitcoin, was when it cruised through 1,000 back at the beginning of last year. So there is significant potential downside potential from Bitcoin at these levels. And not least because you have new emergent cryptocurrencies in a universe of over 500, but IOTA in particular is creating a direct transfer mechanism so that you can use fiat currency to simply buy in and out of IOTA without having to transact first in Bitcoin. And that is a death knell for the mining sector. And it suggests to me that the good money has been made in the Bitcoin market, and that the most likely scenario is that some of the early investors, those that had rather extraordinary fortunes at the top of the bubble in December of last year, could well lose everything. Then I think gold is at a particularly interesting level right now. It pulled back by $22 in here today, and it is at a new reaction low. We can also look at the pullback that we saw in December, and it pulled back sharply from $13 to $1,240, but then it was short-term oversold, so we started to get a rally, and the rally took us up over $120. Well, gold needs to rally smartly and do it soon if the downward bias is to be arrested. Over the course of the last year and a half, it has dipped below the trend mean, and it is now encountering resistance in the region of the trend mean. So it needs to rally, and it needs to rally quickly if the potential for a further test of the downside is to be avoided. This is no longer looking like a particularly bullish chart, but it hasn't been particularly consistent either. So then therefore there is the potential that we could see a further test of underlying trading before we get the next bounce. That is one of the natures of an inconsistent trend, is that one has to be tolerant of occasional inconsistencies. It makes trading rather difficult, unfortunately. Silver failed to sustain the move above $17 and came right back down to test the $16.50 area. This is a similar failed break to what we saw in April, and now the question will be whether the $16 area is going to hold. Platinum was also in negative territory. It hadn't rallied by particularly much, but it was down by $22 and back below the $900 area once more, coming back down towards the closing lows that we saw in May. So again, this has been a really quite marked deterioration in the precious metals, and they really do have quite a bit of work to do to reassert demand dominance. By the same token, the Gold Bugs Index of gold miners was certainly in negative territory, but not in the same dynamic fashion, and most particularly because it hasn't rallied by very much. It has been particularly inert, but mostly below the trend mean. If we get downside follow-through, well, that does open up the potential that it is going to continue to move lower from here. I did a review of some of the UK gold miners yesterday, but considering that they led on the downside, they were relatively unchanged in here today. Well, I started off this broadcast talking about the difference, or I think the challenges that Western Europe has, and the way that the European or the emerging markets have benefited from globalization. But China has benefited more than anybody else. And the fact that the dollar is rallying and that Chinese commodity demand is waning, or is potentially waning, or even that the growth in that commodity demand may not rise at the same pace, well, that is definitely putting downward pressure on some of the commodity-related emerging markets. Brazil has broken its uptrend, and now it has broken the progression of higher reaction lows. And it is oversold in the short term, but the Brazilian real is now trending lower. And it tested the four to the dollar level, but so far its ability to sustain the rally, I think that this is a rather important level, that it was in weaker territory yesterday. It was able to recoup some of that decline in here today, but It is all down to what the central banks do and just how aggressive they're willing to be in supporting their currencies. What that also is translating into is that the USA is exporting its monetary policy. By the strength of the dollar putting pressure on these economies, it is forcing them to raise interest rates faster than they might have necessarily wanted. The Mexican peso is also declining, and there is the prospect that the country is going to be, or that the next election is going to be won by a left-wing populist. So that is going to represent a rather interesting contrast in NAFTA negotiations, where you have a right-wing populist and negotiating with a left-wing populist. The South African rand has continued to trend lower, and it does look like now that really it would be a sustained move below the trend mean to question dollar dominance in this particular currency. Then India has been attempting to support the rupee around the 69 area, and the dollar is in fresh positive territory again in here. I think that the most likely scenario is that it is going to get back up towards that 69 level before the RBI moves in to support the currency once more. When we look at the outlook for the Indian market, then the Nifty was in mildly positive territory in here today. But that is being flattered by the relative performance of the currency. And if we look at the performance of India-related share or funds, then it really does need to sustain a move back above the trend mean. And so far, we don't have a great deal of evidence to support the view that it is about to do that imminently. So, India has an awful lot going for it. That it's on the cusp of a digital revolution, and it really has the potential to have a digital consumer market similar to what China has today within the decade, and that is likely to be transformative for the economy. But that does not mean that it is immune from what's going on out there in the wider world. It does already have. It is not a major manufacturing center, and it has a big domestic demand growth story already. So it's not under the same kind of pressure as countries like Brazil or South Africa. But the relative weakness of the currency and the rise of oil prices over the last year has put pressure on the economy. Therefore, the lower oil prices, lower commodity prices, should be beneficial for a country like India, and it should help to ensure that it is not under the same pressure as some of those weaker currencies. Then, if we look at what's going on in Turkey, well, the Turkish lira was in an additional weak territory yesterday and followed through on the upside, the dollar followed through on the upside in here today. This is a currency that's been trending lower for a really significant amount of time already, and it's generally when it stops trending that the stock market tends to pick up. But the stock market is not picking up right now. In fact, it is now it has broken its progression of higher reaction lows. It is below the trend mean, and it is trending lower. There is a short-term oversold condition, but it has a lot of work to do to reconfirm demand dominance. Generally speaking, with in markets where currencies are accelerating lower or testing new lows, it is really only when investors have got confidence that the currency has stopped going down that people really start to get interested once more. International investors like to have the currency and the stock market both in their favor. And the renminbi was in additional negative territory in here today. And it is coming, and the dollar is coming back up to test the trend mean. Well, the Chinese were strengthening the currency over the course of the last year. Part of the reason for that was a selfish domestic motive that they were trying to arrest the demand for capital flight, and it was largely successful. On the other hand, it was also that they were trying to, I think, appease the demands from the USA and Europe to stop competing on the currency front. But one of the clearest weapons that China has on in a trade war footing is to weaken the currency. And if we see the renminbi breaking back below the trend mean, then that is going to represent an indication that that is exactly what they're doing. But it's not going to be particularly good news for their stock market. But it would help to make their manufacturing sector more competitive. So when we look at the wider world, there is a clear, I think, relative bias to the US dollar, because when people are looking for the strong currency and the strong stock market in tandem, well, that's exactly what you have today in Wall Street. And if we look at the dollar index over a really long time scale, well, if we cast our minds back to the mid-1990s, the dollar rallied from 80 to 120 over the course of that 7 years. And that 50% appreciation in the currency happened at a time when the stock market was the best performing stock market in the world. So international investors were able to pick up both the currency and the capital market appreciation in the USA. And there is now the potential for that to happen again, that the dollar index completed its base formation in 2014. It spent most of the last 3.5 years not doing very much. But the reality now is that it has bounced from the region of the trend mean. It has broken the downward bias that was in evidence for all of 2017. And there is an increasingly likely potential that it is going to be able to sustain a move back up towards 100 at least. So then if we think about where are we in terms of the cycle for the S&P 500, then it broke upwards in 2013, and so far the pace of the advance certainly picked up at the end of last year, and we're in this pause and consolidation now that has been going on for 4 months already. Well, we tend to think of medium-term corrections as being for anything from 6 to 18 months, and with the Nasdaq 100 breaking up and the Russell 2000 small caps also breaking upwards, then there is the potential that this range could be on the shorter side of that medium-term time horizon. Well, eventually we're going to have a recession. I think the most important point is that there's no great deal of evidence to support the conclusion that it's going to be imminent. The yield curve spread is now at 37 basis points, and it was at 40 yesterday. So the pace of the decline and the contraction in this spread continues. Well, eventually it's going to become negative, and usually then we have a lead indicator for anything from 6 to 18 months for the next recession to take hold. Generally speaking, before you have a recession, you're going to start to see the high yield spreads breaking out in the upside. And that's not happening right now. In fact, they've been completely inert for a year and a half already. So that is, I think, a rather bullish factor. Unemployment is at record lows, and it's usually that in before a recession, unemployment starts to rise. So that's also a point that's, I think, negated, and then we don't have oil prices that are surging higher. In fact, they're in a corrective phase right now. So what that suggests is that this is a medium-term correction in stock markets, and that we're already seeing the relative strength leaders breaking on the upside. Now, obviously, everything else that's going on out there in the wider world is a problem. That if we do have trade wars, and that has a greater impact on China than it does on anywhere else, well, that's going to represent a problem. Well, maybe if we get out to 2 years from now, it could be one of the causal factors in China having a recession, and then that would have a knock-on effect for just about everywhere else. So That's a one potential outcome from this set of scenarios. And that, of course, would create a medium-term bear market for Wall Street, but it would be unlikely to derail the secular bull market. And that is the kind of environment that we do get within a secular bull market. The primary arguments for why we have a secular bull market is because of technological innovation, because of the role that it's having in the energy sector, and the creation of enabling technologies. That 5G is a massively enabling technology. The fact that you also have genetic sequencing and genetic editing, that's another incredibly enabling technology. There is the realistic possibility that we could have cures for large numbers of cancers within the decade, and that cancer spending in the globe per year is $1 trillion. If it's not the second, it's certainly close to the second largest cost center for the global economy. And energy is the other one. And we have massive innovation in the energy sector, whether that is in battery technology, solar, wind, and the lead time for when we can get a fusion reactor up and running is decreasing all the time. Then you have the rise of the global consumer, that demand growth in terms of just about everything that a consumer might want is going to continue to increase over the course of the next few decades. We're going to have an additional 2 billion consumers. Well, in a bipolar world, that is something that could potentially represent a challenge from the perspective of the consumer staple type companies. But when we also think about the longer term trends, there is the fact that US 10-year treasuries are right at the upper side of what I think is a base, and they continue to pause. If we see a sustained move above 3%, well, then we would have pretty good evidence that the base has been completed above 4%, and I think it's incontrovertible. If we look at the really long end of the curve, all the way out to the 30-year yield, and look at that on a long-term basis, well, we can also see that it's at the upper side of a base that's been going on now for 3.5 years already. And the upper side of that base is around the 3.25% level. And it needs to sustain a move above that level to confirm a return to supply dominance. But one of the important points about this almost, I really don't think it's an exaggeration to say that we have an identity crisis in the West. It's that people want to get paid more money. They want to have better standards of living. And that they're going to get it one way or the other, whether they have to vote for it and directly support inflationary measures. And there is the realistic possibility that that is what is going to happen. That means that they may not be getting the better living standards, but they'll feel like they're getting something of a better living standard because they've more money in their pockets. They might have a better or they might have a greater choice about what they want to spend it on. Well, these are some of the key arguments that we have. It's not urgent today because bond yields have not yet completed their base formations, but there's a realistic possibility that it is going to happen, that we're going to have a complete change, that these trends in fixed income do not last forever. And when they change, it means an all change for just about everything. And what it probably suggests is that we are going to have a longer period of time where we're going to have political upset. It takes a long time for these things to work their way through. And that means that inflation is out there on the horizon, but also that we have debt problems and that there is a massive amount of debt, and the easy way to get rid of that debt is to inflate it. So I think with that, I will leave you for the weekend, and I'll wish all the best to all of you. All right. Thanks, Sam.